This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
It's now time for Sensing Bros, a program with a focus on youth well-being.
This program is about natural buzz. There's a group of us brothers who are living alcohol and drug free, and we want to share our stories and celebrate the things that are going right in the world. There's a lot of negativity. We're about positivity. We come from diverse cultural backgrounds, Samoan, Tongan, Māori, and we just want to share the love. Welcome to Sensing Bros. Sometimes, you know, I think wherever you be, wherever you are, it's nice just to be able to say I've done enough today. And so bringing you into the show today with a Dave Dobbin classic done by Mark Vanilau and Scribe, two of Christchurch's most accomplished musicians, and it's a beautiful rendition of Dobbin's song It Dawned On Me.
Yeah. This song right here is a tribute to one of our idols, one of the true legends of New Zealand music, and a very good friend, Mr. Dave Dobbin. It's an honor to be here tonight. Mark Vanilau on the keys. I go by a couple names.
Days go by, ain't gon' lie. Times get hard, but I ain't gon' cry. Even though we struggling, I ain't gon' stop. I'ma keep my head up to the sky. Another day go by, ain't gon' lie. Times get hard, but I ain't gon' cry. Even though we struggling, I ain't gon' stop. I'ma keep my head up to the sky. Sky, sky.
There's a blue black sky, stole the west horizon. Under ocean souls, hear the tolling bell. On the seventh wave rides my aspiration. They will break for sure for my dreams to tell.
And it dawned on me.
It dawned on me. It just dawned on me. Must be what your heart reveals.
Blood red, blue, purple to cover. Black dunes hiss with the grass's breath. I'll gather my driftwood and light a beacon. It's for you I cry, it's for you I burn. And it dawned on me. It dawned on me. It just dawned on me. Must be what your heart reveals. And hey, it just dawned on me for the first time. Must be what your heart reveals. 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 It must be what your heart, your heart, your heart. But I ain't gon' cry. Even though we struggling, I ain't gon' stop. I'ma keep my head up to the sky. Another day go by, ain't gon' lie. Times get hard, but I ain't gon' cry. Even though we struggling, I ain't gon' stop. I'ma keep my head up to the sky. See the days go by, ain't gon' lie. Times get hard, but I ain't gon' cry. Even though we struggling, I ain't gon' stop. I'ma keep my head up to the sky. Cause the days go by, ain't gon' lie. Times get hard, but I ain't gon' cry. Even though we struggling, I ain't gon' stop. I'ma keep my head up to the sky. Sky, 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 sky.
dawned on me.
You're the man, Dave.
So I've got a conversation with my good friend and also a counsellor in the addiction field and someone I've known, and it's been a privilege to know, for a very long time, Norman Vaiali.
That creaky sound that you may be hearing is Norman sitting on my my new leather-brown two-seater couch, man. Yeah, I'm so pleased. So please, it's...
And the snoring you might be hearing is me falling asleep on it.
Yeah! Can you hear that squeaky? Squeaky. Give it a squeak, man. Ah! No, I'm really grateful to have my couch. Yeah, a trade me deal. And my pillow. Where's my pillow? Oh, my pillow. My pillow was down from $100 to $60. It was a 40% sale, man. So when I put my head on it, bro, it was like I felt like a king. Did I tell you?
No.
It was like I just got flooded with joy, like because I've got
that comfortable,
bro. It was so comfortable. Like my feet were in pain because sometimes I get pain in my feet, but my head was in heaven. And I can, this feeling of joy that I could rest my head on this pillow that kings would have rested their heads on in different times.
Yep.
I just had that just, sure, because I've got one other pillow that's a duck feather pillow, which is about like 25 years old, you know, and then these foam ones, which are just foam ones. I thought, man, how rich am I?
So what's the $60 one made of?
Yeah, down.
Oh
yeah. So yeah. Anyway.
So sleeping on ducks.
Well, I did think about the feathers, and and you know the individual ducks they came from. But I thought after all this time, somewhere to rest my head. That's just like it just sinks in.
Yeah, man.
It's beautiful. A beautiful, beautiful thing. So so we'll start with that, eh? What I'm grateful for.
That's good, mate.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, do you want to introduce yourself?
And yeah.
So welcome to CT. Sorry, man.
My name is Norman Yosia Menevaele. Born in Christchurch, first generation New Zealand born Samoan. I'm married with three children. My wife's a clinical psychologist. And I'm an addictions practitioner, but a team leader for an alcohol and drug service.
Why? No.
Why am I on the...
Why do you, yeah, that's the big question, really. Why? I like asking people, why do you do what you do?
Why do I do what I do? It's probably an easier question to sort of answer once I was in the field, because I didn't know it before I got into the field.
Yeah.
But once I was in the field, I just loved it. Loved working with people, hearing their stories. Being there to sort of help people move through different struggles and adversity that they have in life. Yes, I felt so well placed.
Yeah.
But before that, I had no idea it was a field I wanted to get into. It was sort of just there, got into it by accident. A job came up and I applied for it and got it. And then part of the benefit of getting the job was that they wanted to build the Pacific workforce in Christchurch. And so part of my job description and contract was that I get trained up to be a clinician.
Wow. But why are you still in the field? Because that's been, you've been here a while now, eh?
I think about 14 years now.
Yeah, yeah.
I just love it. I just love this field. I love the people that are in the field. It's a field that looks after people as much as possible, but it's also a real a high pressure, high volume sort of environment. Well, there are a lot of people that actually need help with addictions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I enjoy the challenge of it too.
Yeah.
I think if it wasn't so challenging, I'd probably get quite bored. And I need those challenges in order for me to sort of just feel like I'm doing something in life.
Yeah, it's meaningful, eh?
It's meaningful, yeah.
I get joy when I see other people making just really good, wise choices and informed choices about their own lives.
Yeah.
You know, and people expressing what's most important to them and then fighting for it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But it's interesting because in the addictions field, you're often telling people not to fight. Because they've been fighting all their lives, and the sort of net outcome of them fighting all their lives is that substances are used to try and alleviate all the stress.
That's right, eh? What that fight is, you know?
Yeah.
And how to live and find... Well, we were talking about this in group today. You know, one of the things is we find enjoyment in other things. We actually get a life back that we're enjoying things that are good for us.
Yeah, but there's always a deeper... Yeah. I always find that there's a deeper sort of question that sits underneath the surface of it all. For example, like in the field, you get taught a lot of skills of how to help people sort of manage emotions,
yeah.
How to overcome anxiety and depression, and there's a range of different options for that sort of stuff from, you know, the sort of biomedical approaches right through to psychological approaches.
Yeah.
But oftentimes I'm finding there's a philosophical edge that we don't address in the field.
Yeah.
And that's the part that I actually love the most, because there's a lot of writers in New Zealand that talk about this metaphysical space but don't really elaborate on what that means or what that is within addictions.
Wow.
Yeah, so an example of that would be, you know, someone comes in to a service with severe addiction problems, mental health problems, but one of the sort of soul searches that they're looking for is just to be loved.
Right.
And so one of the things that I've always found as part of my therapeutic approach is to help them define what love means to them. And then out of that comes a whole bunch of meaning, because if you can define it properly for people, and that definition is rooted also in their own philosophical search, because they're often looking at it philosophically, because experientially they haven't lived it out.
Mm.
But they know that there's this space where they should be heading towards but aren't quite getting there for whatever reason. Yeah.
Mm.
So it's been exciting.
That whole space, man, that's something I really want to explore more.
Because
I know what you mean around, you know, I approach things not so much from the psychiatric disorder framing, but more from the developmental psychology framing.
Yep.
And then I think about that in terms of most of that people that I'm looking at and thinking about are bringing out an evolutionary secular kind of assumptions and premises about that, and so I wonder how to integrate that with spirituality and Wairoa and theology and philosophy.
Yeah.
And it's really important to have that bigger discussion, because it goes to the heart of not just the biology for desire, which this guy, have you come across Mark Lewis?
No.
Yeah, he's in an addiction article. The whole listener did it last week.
Yeah,
pretty interesting, eh?
What was he say?
Oh, he's a he's a developmental psychologist who's put out ideas that are more critical of the disease model. Yeah, he's also studied in neuroscience, and he's got a book out, Memoirs of an Addict.
Yeah,
because he's been through that journey himself, and he's now a professor in the field. So really, really wanting to sort of, I think he draws quite a nice balance in the discussion, but he's also positioned himself here in terms of working with people with addiction. That's not contained within a disease model.
Yeah,
he's more into neuroplasticity, the capacity to change, but recognises too that there's you know, it takes more of a narrative story in approach, a bit more like this guy Johan Hardy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But anyway, that's a so Because I do want to ask you about your musicianship,
mm-hmm.
and your, at the end,
mm-hmm.
but because you are a philosopher.
Well,
you know you're. Yeah,
I like it. I enjoy it.
You enjoy it, eh?
Yeah.
Do you want to say something a bit more about how you integrate your worldview into your practice?
How I integrate my worldview into my practice.
Yeah.
I mean, most of it is just lived.
Okay.
Like, I have a philosophy on life that's around how to treat people or how to be with people. And I try my best to keep that as consistent as possible across all of the domains of my life, so it's not sort of fractured or compartmentalized or anything like that. I try and avoid those sorts of traps as much as possible, and I see them as traps because I've just found oftentimes people really struggle to, for example, if they have a faith in something, they struggle to implement that faith into a specific sort of vocation that they're in. As an example, remember when we talked at the CP symposium?
Yes.
And
yeah, that's
the coexisting problem symposium.
Yeah, the first one, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was a nurse that approached me afterwards and said, "Thank you for sort of sharing what your views were on your faith and how you integrated into your work, because it gave me permission to just be myself in my own workplace." So she lived this compartmentalized.
Nice. Yeah.
Sort of life, because she works in an area in an agency where secularism is actually the norm, and so I work in an area where secularism is a norm as well. I think the only difference between us is that I've found ways to sort of talk about the metaphysical space without having to sort of Bible bash people, as an example. You know, without having to share specifically that Jesus is the answer to all of these sort of worries and questions and all that sort of business, and that you can actually engage in an intellectual discussion with people without having to invoke just a real simple view of faith.
Yeah,
that, you know, faith and spirituality isn't incompatible with, say, biology or psychiatry or psychology, that they can actually complement each other really well. In fact, I think one of them, philosophy as an example, or philosophy and theology, can create really nice frameworks for psychology and psychiatry to operate in.
Bro, so what I've experienced in the field, A, is that conversation needs to be nurtured, and it's only coming into the training recently as a real conversation.
Yeah, I think it's been happening for a long, long time, but like, spirituality always gets designated to this sort of tokenism. People are happy to talk about it, but as long as it doesn't invade the real space where psychiatry and psychology live, then you're sweet.
Yeah.
But it is actually invading those spaces, and it invades it in real practical ways. And we can't sort of ignore it purely because of some kind of stance or school of thought.
Yeah.
That there are plenty of people who present to services actually looking for some proper meaning in life. And they're looking for some proper solutions to love, or the lack of love, or the lack of care, or the lack of purpose. And so you can't ignore those things. And so I always find myself sort of getting into it and having a conversation, helping people try and build a picture in their mind first of what purpose sort of looks like for them. Real purpose.
Yeah.
Not an artificial or an illusion of purpose.
Yeah, or fulfilling someone else's expectation and being divorced from your own sense of what I want my life to be about.
But I think that's where secularism comes in.
Yeah.
Because quite often you'll have, say, in psychiatry, you'll have the secularist approach to spirituality versus biochemical sort of modelling and all that sort of stuff.
So the tendency to pathologise it, in other words, where... Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I honestly don't see too much of a problem around there. I have a problem with, say, just throwing out the word addictions, because then it just pathologises everything.
Yeah.
But what I've just sort of found is that not even psychiatry can escape the same questions, you know, around meaning and purpose and all that sort of stuff. I remember taking this really elderly gentleman over to, where was it, specialist mental health. They needed to assess him because he's had a little, you know, years and years of depression. He's got years and years of alcoholism, and he was struggling to stay off it. But the one thing that helped him to stay away from alcohol for a decent period of time was feeling a sense of purpose in the church that he was attending. Now, he was socially really inadequate, but what he found meaning from was he'd go to church and he'd be an usher. And that gave him enough purpose to not want to use alcohol for a decent period of time. He'd look after himself and shower, and then when things didn't work out in that space, he returned back to the same way he was before, getting back into heavy alcohol use, not looking after himself. And so when I took him to this appointment, they immediately went to pathologising this guy, and it gave him no sense of comfort or no sense of pretty much anything. He got nothing from that. They were just looking at putting him on medication and all that sort of stuff, which I understand has its role and purpose. But this guy wasn't looking for that. He was actually looking for some purpose and meaning. And when I said to the psychiatrist, what can you do for a person that is only looking for purpose and meaning? He just ignored the question and just kept moving on.
Did he really?
Yeah, he did. But not every psychiatrist is like that. There are some psychiatrists out there that actually engage in that conversation really, really well.
Yeah, I think I'm involved with some situation where I'm going to have to do a similar thing. Well, the psychiatric lens is designed to categorise and find the disorder and name it as such and then medicate. And so the meaning question is where it should be central. Is on the outside of that. It's a conversation you have to bring in.
Yep.
Yeah. But it can work. Talking therapies, medication. There's a guy called Dr. Breggin, bro, on YouTube. Breggin. Beautiful man. He's like in his 80s, eh? And he's a psychiatrist who talks about loving people, and then has a lot to do. A lot of the people that he's still seeing.
Yep.
Is about understanding and a lot of them medicated long term, and just helping them through a process of coming off medication, which he sees as one of the medication's important, but he also believes it's the best approach is to also, in the treatment planning, have the plan to work a person off.
Yep.
And that's there's a huge opioid problem in the States. Huge, it's, you know, so it's around that, and it's around the fuller people reclaiming a fuller sense of control over what's happening to them in their lives and finding that purposely. Yeah, do you feel in control, man? Do you know what I mean? Yeah, you know what I mean? It's just, there was some research I was reading about where I'll just say it like this real quick. They studied bureaucracy, right? It was a big study in Whitehall, and the theory was that the people who were at the executive levels would have more stress and be more prone, possibly, to depression because they're carrying the big decisions. What they found out when they went in, it wasn't those. It was the frontliners who had more stress on them when they had less control. The factor of managing sort of life and in a working bureaucratic situation was because when they got less and less control, and the guys who were sitting at the top
had all the levers.
Yeah, so often it's that story about the storm in life, or what's overwhelming you, or do you feel in control. That's what that sort of conversation's about, eh?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one, eh? Because like when you think about capacity, all the frontline,
yeah,
frontline workers.
Yeah.
You've got a whole bunch of contracts and different sort of union organisations that are there to try and create equity amongst in their hierarchy of power.
Yeah.
But I guess the frontline, we sort of often don't think about our own utility within our own lives.
Yeah.
But we sort of sell ourselves off a bit short that, you know, this job, I really, really need it.
Yeah.
It's the only job that I'm ever going to get type of mentality. And one of the things that I do with a lot of my team is don't sell yourself short. You know, nice. if you're wanting to sort of market yourself and get yourself into a better position vocationally, then upskill.
Yeah,
upskill and make yourself marketable, because it won't matter if people want to try and control you, just leave and find a job that you're going to find equal sort of purpose in and equal value in. Yeah. And I think we sort of devalue ourselves at that sort of lower end quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And if people sort of see their own worth a lot sooner, then I think, you know, it probably would create a lot more of an even keel in that space, because all of a sudden the levers aren't there up at that upper echelon anymore. You know, they actually moved down.
Yeah. I like that, bro, because it's about... I'm the workforce, just generally speaking... I really love it. I really care about it. Our workforce, not because I have to. It's because we're on a similar kind of mission in life, you know. And I see a lot of our workforce under what looks like pressure, stress. And I think, and it's more than just saying, hey, self-care. It's the thing around it is, okay, what are the expectations you're perceiving others are having of you in this role, and what are the expectations you have of yourself? And what you were saying just kind of names it, have a high value on your worth and move on if you need to, upskill, do some other training,
take yourself a lot more seriously, because like the people that I've met along the pathway who have felt like, you know, their worth and their value just hasn't gotten them anywhere, I think to some degree there's the sort of pawning off of their own responsibility for their own individual journey. And I'm just not a fan of that sort of school of thought, you know. I'd much rather people sort of take themselves seriously and know that they are of worth and value, but it's up to them to prove their worth and value. It's not up to heads of organisation to say you're worth this and you're worth this. Because that may be the starting point for a conversation, but doesn't have to end there. But that's if you're a person who is actually looking for some value in terms of monetary sort of value in what you do and stuff. I'm not particularly lined up that way. I like money, like most people, to pay bills and look after kids and all that sort of stuff, but it's not my drive.
You know, your story was told in something recently, eh? Which I'd like to come back to at some point, so that people could just know where you've journeyed, where you've come from, and
it
deserves much more than 5 minutes.
Yeah, no, all good.
So we'll do that, eh? We'll come back to that as well.
Yes, it is.
But in a nutshell, well, how would you summarize it, if you could, in maybe 3 or 4 sentences about your journey, where you've come from, where you are now, where you're heading?
Oh, that'd be quite hard. I was just thinking about it, that probably the things that stand out for me around the journey has been, you know, poor parental supervision, high aggression, hatred in the teens, don't care in the teens, get into drugs early, and sex early, and then everything just sort of becomes chaotic, you know. And it was out of chaos that I tried to sort of just operate and then had to learn from.
Wow.
In a nutshell.
In a nutshell? That is a nutshell, but wow. And because you've got a loving family, man, eh? And you're settled in that space, and you're forging ahead in your workspace.
And you're also...
But just adding into that...
You're also the person I like to hang around with. But also, what were you going to say?
I mean, just to add a human element to that whole relational space, because I use my relational story in a lot of our group work, and they love it, man. They love it just because it lets them know that actually we're not far from each other on this. The bridge that they have to build isn't as long as it seems. But in a relational space, me and my wife, we go cats and dogs when we argue, and we have some pearls.
Yeah.
You know? But one of the things that I love about those moments is that it shows how human we are, you know, how fragile we are as well. Yeah. But the beauty of the whole picture is that love is at the centre of our relationship.
Beautiful.
And so when it comes to working things through, we don't have all of these insecurities about whether this argument is about whether we love each other. That's just a given. The rub always comes when it gets down to things like communication, who's right and who's wrong.
Mm.
And oftentimes we have to call on other values in order to re-establish our communication. Like things like having some humility, you know. Things like accepting that you've got it wrong.
Being wrong, or no, I am right. Well, it's a reset with kindness, eh?
Yes. Yeah. And then there's a whole bunch of patience that comes in with the kindness, and you can't live without those things. As soon as you remove those things from the picture, man, you better be prepared for a rough ride.
I often think about 1 Corinthians, that love is patient and kind. It's the first beginning of that beautiful beautiful statement about what love is. I said, why patient?
No, that's so true.
It's true, eh?
Yeah, that's so true. But I also love the whole, it keeps no records of wrongs.
Because
we can often try and clock up, eh?
Yeah.
Clock up the amount of wrongs this person has done against me.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if love is the idea that it just doesn't keep records of that stuff, that it forgives where it needs to forgive, and does a whole bunch of other things that biologically would go against your own self-interest. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or developmentally, because a lot of those schools of thoughts I just sort of find a little bit too reductionist for me.
Yeah.
Because things like love and things like patience and kindness actually moves against some of that.
Yeah.
In lots of ways, because the struggle of the fittest and the strongest and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
Typically overcome.
Yeah.
You know, all of those sort of battles, and if it doesn't work, you just move on.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if you're wanting people to build proper interpersonal relationships, it's not about just leaving things behind and moving on.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's about looking back and rebuilding.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's about rebuilding with people that actually matter, who are going to be there for the long haul.
Wow. That's cool, man. We did a group this morning around working out friendships and intimacy and long haul, and the values of knowing that the people we're close to, we know... treasure what we treasure, but that's more than being just like minded. You know, there's lots of diversity in thinking. That it's because at their heart, at their core, they want us to succeed in what we're doing, and they have an understanding of what's important to us. So, one of the questions I ask people is, do you know what's the people that you say you're close to? What's really important to them? You know, and when was the last time you asked somebody that you were close to what's important to them at the moment? Those sort of things, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. But I think it's sort of, you know, as you start to work through those steps, like the lower steps, in terms of just reasoning out, you know, why am I going in this direction? Yeah. Why do I choose to want to be patient or be a little bit more kind and all that sort of stuff? As you start to get those things grounded in your language, grounded in your thoughts, grounded in your belief system, the next step to it is that you have to actually work with a whole bunch of adversity, you know, to build up even deeper relationships in that. As an example, like a lot of guys in addictions, they've burnt a lot of their bridges.
Yeah.
So in order for them, you know, patience and kindness isn't going to get them there. Oftentimes they actually have to fight, and that's a fight that's worthy of fighting.
Yeah, nice.
You know, because there's a fight that's not worthy. Like, if you've been fighting against all of your own internal sort of emotions and inadequacies and all that sort of stuff, and just found that you're using substances or some kind of addiction behaviour to ameliorate those intrapsychic sort of problems. It sort of helps to sort of move beyond that into another realm where you put the fighting down and just learn to sort of surrender yourself, so that you know you're not causing all this extra angst and frustration and all that sort of stuff and anxiety that comes along with it, especially when it comes to trying to overcome that stuff. Sometimes it just helps to surrender yourself and allow whatever it is. Some people lean towards God, some people just lean towards the fact that I'm tired, you know, just an idea of I'm exhausted. And it's through this surrender that people actually find another way through something, because all of a sudden they just have to accept that it's there, need to sit with it being there, and then find a solution to it, you know. And people often do that. But there's another layer that I think is just as equally important, but that comes down to maturity as you start to mature out, when you actually need supporters to be there, but they're not there because you've burnt all those bridges, or they've burnt bridges with you. And those are the ones you actually have to fight for. There's more than just the patience and the kindness that needs to go in at that point. You know, it's good judgment, it's stickability, it's endurance, it's persistence. There's a whole bunch of courage, a whole bunch of other values that actually need to kickstart in to help you rebuild that interpersonal space in more meaningful ways.
That ego tiredness, we're fighting, but you can't think your way out of it, and it's just, it does, it wears people down. So that whole, that thing about finding some place and space to have peace, or moments where you can just, you know, reevaluate everything. And then the healing and the restoration of relationships and the equanimity that goes on.
But I've just found that they just never find it until they surrender.
Yeah, that's interesting, man. And then with that surrender, are you suggesting that then they become open to the learning?
I think so.
The new learning, yeah.
I think so.
Wow.
Because
I agree.
Because there's a level of rigidness that disappears at that point, eh?
That's right.
Because you get so caught up in that sort of fight-flight type of mentality, and you get so caught up in real solid, what do you call it?
Rigid is a good way of sort of, it's a rigid way of being and approaching the world. You lose your agility to respond.
Yeah, no, that's right. It becomes really concrete.
Yeah.
And you actually need to move from concrete to more abstract ways of working things through, because if you don't get the abstract ways, you don't get the adaptability.
Yeah.
And you know, the maladaptiveness is around that concrete sort of way of working through problems. So you just keep doing the same things over and over, expecting something different.
Yeah,
it just never works. And I remember having a conversation with one of my colleagues this morning, and we're having this disagreement around, do people in addictions, you know, her view was that people in addictions need to become accustomed with pain. And I said, no, I think you're wrong there. They're very accustomed with pain. They know exactly what pain is. They just don't like it when it's there for long periods of time. Instead of new substances to give them a bit of a break from the struggle.
Yeah, if it's a way of saying, yes, we're going to suffer in life, but there's suffering that's unnecessary. There's suffering that we can alleviate. And there's some suffering we will have to endure. That's life. Hey, man. I want to keep going, but I can't. I mean, because I know that, you know, there's so much more that's...
Mate, we'll go on for ages.
So, in terms of musicianship, man.
Yep.
Because I know that June the 13th is a special day.
June 3rd.
13th, did I say?
Yeah,
3rd. 3rd, man. Such a professional. June the 3rd. Is Jazz and Blues Arts Festival.
Yep.
Do you want to just say a little bit about that and who you're playing with and what's going on?
Oh, so there's a jazz festival that's on June the 3rd, and we've been asked to play at the piano on that day. But, you know, playing with Tribal Links, we haven't played for a long time. But all the sort of organisers of Jazz Fest will remember us from back in the day.
Yeah.
And they were pretty excited about it. And we're pretty excited about it as well. Yeah. So it's going to be fun. So all of the stuff that me and Phil was just finished talking about, that's actually influenced within the lyrics of a lot of my songs.
Yeah.
And so Mark, who's also another songwriter in Tribal Links, like a lot of his songs are really deep, you know, and it gets to the heart of some a lot of the things that we've actually discussed today.
Yeah. Beautiful, eh?
Mm.
That's soulful. So I'm looking forward to it, man.
Yeah, man. Same.
And it's a nice photo. Nice photo, Sarah. So June 3rd, people have a look up. You can Google the Jazz and Blues Festival, or is it the Blues and Jazz Festival?
It's Jazz Festival. It might be Jazz and Blues. Actually,
yeah,
you might be right.
Jazz before blues, people.
Yeah, that's
blues
right.
Blues before jazz.
Even though it's going to have a lot of rock in it.
Yeah, yeah.
So June 3rd at the piano. That's where we jam.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And so I'm going to play a song. I don't know what song it is, but here it is. You got any song preferences you want me to?
Man, just jam whatever you've got.
Oh. You want to do an impromptu?
Nah.
It was worth a shot. It was worth a shot. Yeah, I know, I was leading into it, aren't I? Not even like 30 seconds?
Nah, not even 30 seconds.
Okay. Oh, good, bro.
If this one was working, I would have.
Oh, yeah, because this one's not
this
so good.
This one's a little harder to play.
Yeah.
The string's a little bit higher.
I knew I should have strung that one yesterday. I had it in my heart
nice,
to string
it's
it.
Nice and low.
I know, that one's like a little bit higher on it, eh?
Yeah, good, harder on the fingers. And my fingers are out of practice.
No, very good. Okay, so what we say on Sensing Bros is, what are you sensing, bro?
Sense you later, bro.
Sense you later. Yeah. No, thank you heaps, man. It's
all good, Phil. All good, brother.
And we will be talking more.
Aye.
Yes. Love you. Just following up on that, I thought I'd give you a couple of the references to some of the people we mentioned as we were chatting. Mark Lewis's book, and you can also find him on YouTube, is Memoirs of an Addicted Brain. Johan Hari's book, Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions, is a great read. Very helpful. And Dr. Peter Breggin spelled Breggin, worth looking up. So as we close, just a reminder that Jazz and Blues Festival runs from May the 30th to June the 3rd, and Mark Vanilleau and Norman and the guys Tribal Links will be playing at the piano on the 3rd. I'll be there, loving it. The song Simplicity comes to mind, and we're just going to go out on that beautiful song written by Mark. And by resting, just tell yourself today, I've done enough. Go well.
Take 2 seconds, say something kind. Picture box with devices and advisors. Consume all our humanity. No longer mealtime sharing, slaves, slaving, pursuing better things. But deep down lies a knowledge that we got to take this all back to simplicity. Seasons change, but your heart beats the same. And little else but love will always remain. So stop living the life that life will never get any better. 'Cause it all comes back down to simplicity. I love you, and it don't get said no simpler than that. Oh no, I need you to know that.
that this is all about a pathway to better and better. And if you want to be free too, no need to complicate this, stay simple. Oh, what a life, so wondrous, so marvelous. Seasons change, but your heart beats the same. And little else but love will always remain. So stop living the life, the life will never get any better. Cause it all comes back down to some seasons change, but your heart beats the same. Little else but love will always remain. So stop living the life, the life will never get any better. Cause it all comes back down to simplicity.
Practice what you preach, and won't you turn the other cheek?